Welcome to Federal Insights for May, sponsored by NEC Corporation.
Welcome to another edition of Federal Insights. I'm Eric White. While many look at biometrics and facial recognition as budding fields, they've been around probably longer than you think. Early on, security experts saw its potential for identifying people where needed, but also were aware of its possible drawbacks. One of those experts is Jeremy Grant, who is now Managing Director for Technology Business Strategy at the law firm Venable. Before that, he created and led the National Program Office for the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I spoke with him recently to discuss the current, past, and future of the biometrics industry.
Well, I've been at the intersection of identity and cybersecurity since the late 90s, so I started my career as a Senate staffer on Capitol Hill, doing a mix of technology and health policy. And the guy I worked for at the time, Senator Chuck Robb from Virginia, most people don't know, was essentially the legislative godfather, if that's such a term, of smart cards and PKI technology in the U.S. government. Going back to the time when he was in the Marine Corps in the 1960s and 70s and was very frustrated with all the paper-based systems they had, particularly around identity, needing to have a single card, say, just for your meal card on base, just for a non-base driver's license, just to check out a weapon. And when he saw an early smart card in the 1990s, he was pretty tech savvy, said, you know, we could combine all of those cards into a single one. And rather than make people wait in line 2 hours every time something changes, they get promoted, they get moved someplace else to get that new card, you could just update it electronically. So coming in as a 22-year-old Hill staffer right out of college, I was asked to essentially, you know, help lead the staff work behind the scenes to try to get the Defense Department to do something. 4 years later, we had the Common Access Card created. We had NIST engaged, working on standards for smart cards in partnership with industry so that the work that the Defense Department was investing in could also be used by civilian agencies. Basically, everything we have today, integrating smart cards and PKI and other technologies, can be traced back to the work that Chuck Robb did in the Senate back in the 1990s.
So what kind of, back then, what sort of identifying aspects were within those CAC cards and the other things like that?
Great question. Biometrics didn't even play a role at the time. I think biometric technology in the late 90s was considered something that was, you were just starting to see the digitization of fingerprints come on. So I think the FBI around that time had rolled out its AFIS fingerprint database that could, for the first time, start to digitize fingerprints that were captured both at crime scenes as well as from people when they were being fingerprinted and start to run them against each other. But this was, you know, the early days of biometrics. Face recognition, while people were experimenting with it, wasn't reliable at all at the time. It was, you know, really quite early days. And even to get a fingerprint sensor, you know, people take it for granted now that it's just built into their smartphone or their laptop. But back then, it would be a big, bulky piece of hardware that was using optical-based sensors to capture fingerprints. So the technology, I think, has really come a long way.
And why was there the push to go past fingerprints? I guess the question is, why weren't fingerprints good enough? You know, they worked all the way up until this time period, and now all of a sudden we want faces, we want veins. What kind of made that move?
Well, I think fingerprints still do work quite well, and I think it's still probably the most commonly used most commonly used biometric today, certainly when it comes to what people are using, say, to access their devices, smartphones, laptops, whatnot. I think there's always been interest in multimodal biometrics, both from a law enforcement and forensic standpoint, in terms of just as people leave fingerprints at a crime scene, there might also be other digital evidence. You know, say if somebody was captured on a, you know, surveillance video, could you, you know, use something like face recognition to match up who it was? But also for on the consumer side, there's a lot of different ways that you can, you know, figure out who's who. And so I think you're seeing these days, you know, both a lot of focus on the consumer side, leveraging what I would say are active biometrics and devices, taking a selfie or putting your finger down or using voice recognition with what people would call passive behavioral biometrics. You know, I always make the point, if my 7-year-old takes my iPhone from me while I'm on my bank app, my bank can probably tell that somebody who's not me is holding it, because there's certain ways that I interact with my device that the 7-year-old hasn't quite mastered yet to take all of dad's money out of his account. So I think, you know, technology is always evolving. Technology is always marching forward. But, you know, there's different technologies right now, I'd say, and biometrics are at different levels of maturity. And as we focus on the face recognition discussion, I think one of the reasons we're seeing so much debate and controversy over some applications is we're still figuring out how to make this technology work well for people.
And speaking on that facial recognition technology, you said it's at a different level of maturation compared to other ones. What level would you say that technology is at right now?
Well, I think it depends on the application. So, you know, we were talking before about early days of biometrics. And so, you know, I talked about how it wasn't particularly reliable in the 1990s. I think something that actually set the face recognition industry back several years was after the events of September 11th in 2001, the then CEO of a small company who made face recognition essentially hired a PR firm and put on a really big event to try to suggest while he was walking through a metal detector holding a picture of Osama bin Laden and having to go beep, beep, that if we'd only had his technology at all of our TSA, we didn't have TSA checkpoints at the time, just all of the checkpoints at airports, none of this would have happened. And it was a ridiculous statement that was instantly criticized, you know, from all sides because it was just wrong. And so the notion that somehow this would have saved us and saved the lives of thousands of people, I think was just something that was insulting to a lot of people, you know, across government and just the country. And it really soured a lot of people on face recognition and set the industry back. Since then, I think we've seen face recognition emerge as a constructive application in a couple areas. So one has just been, I think, what people are used to these days with their smartphones and their laptops. If you're doing a local match biometric where the face is only stored on the device and you're using it to unlock the device, and people are used to this, whether it's Windows Hello on a Microsoft laptop or Face ID on an iPhone, this is something that people are pretty used to. The second application, and this ties more to law enforcement and Homeland Security, is sorting out that if we were able to get actually a high-quality photograph of somebody, say like what you're doing for a driver's license or passport or visa application, where you're staring straight ahead, there's the proper gray background, controlled lighting, you're not smiling, generally tends to help. If you've noticed, you know, if you were ever asked to you know, pose for a picture and they said don't smile, it's because they're using face recognition behind the scenes. So in the State Department, for example, set up for visas and passports, because they want to make sure that they use face recognition as a tool to try to make sure that two people or one person isn't getting multiple passports or multiple visas. You're seeing this in most of the state DMVs these days as well, where the driver's license bureaus want to make sure that if you come in as Jeremy Grant 1 week for a driver's license, you don't come back a month later under a different identity. And so they'll essentially capture your photograph and then run it against their database of people who already have licenses to make sure that there aren't any duplicates. In that latter application, to be clear, it's not like it's a instant yes-no answer every time. I think much same with fingerprints. These tools are really good at flagging whether there might be a match, and then you generally bring in a forensic examiner who really starts to take a look at the information and makes a final determination. I think the third application, and this is one that I think we've been struggling with for nearly 20 years now, is more surveillance applications. And you're certainly starting to see a lot of this rolled out in places like China, where you now have very high quality video cameras that can see a lot more in terms of granularity and resolution than they've been able to before, and much more sophisticated face recognition algorithms than we've seen in the past. And suddenly you're basically surveilling society and constantly tracking where everybody's going. And I think this is where people start to get uncomfortable, and for pretty good reason. And I think it started to spark some debate here in the U.S. In terms of what sorts of limits, you know, should we be putting on the use of this technology.
As it would have it, I'm actually going to be renewing my driver's license this afternoon. And it is all part of because the state of Maryland where I live is trying to implement the Real ID.
Yep.
Does that factor in? Is that why I'm having to go through this process of bringing in several documents saying I am who I am and it's real and they're probably going to have me not smile on my photo that I take this afternoon?
Yeah, so I don't know exactly what Maryland's DMV uses, but I think most of the DMVs have implemented face recognition separate from Real ID. I think you've seen the vendors who actually do the deliver driver's license systems have basically sold this to them as a feature. And again, it's one that makes sense.
Jeremy Grant is Managing Director for Technology Business Strategy at Venable LLP. Time for a quick break. When we return, I asked Jeremy whether or not humans will still need to be in the driver's seat when it comes to using AI and biometric storage. I'm Eric White.
NEC is the world leader in advanced recognition and artificial intelligence technologies that address today's national defense and homeland security challenges. Their solutions include facial recognition, video surveillance, analytics, intrusion detection, and other biometric security applications delivering scalable end-to-end technology that enables the safety, security, and economic interests of the United States. Large federal agencies, including DHS, rely on NEC's technology on a daily basis. Learn more at necam.com/ARS.
One of the symptoms of using biometric technology means you'll have a ton of data. In order to make use of it, users may need to turn to artificial intelligence. But will the average citizen not only be okay with their physical information being stored, but having computers control it? I posed that question to Jeremy Grant, former NIST executive and current director of technology business strategy at Venable LLP.
Well, I think it depends on the application. So again, you know, where there's a human forensic examiner, that's generally for, you know, situations where you're dealing with law enforcement. So again, you know, and if, you know, your fingerprints somehow pop up at a crime scene and then there's a match, there's generally a latent print examiner who is, you know, on the other end somehow looking at things and going beyond what the machines have done. Although the automation is getting better and better, and the tools, you know, that we have there. I mean, look, everything keeps getting more capable and smarter every year. And so, look, as long as we're talking about face recognition just for, say, limited security or law enforcement applications, I think that's something that's been with us for some time and people are comfortable with it. It's really more of the surveillance applications, or if you start talking about putting face recognition in retail or a whole bunch of other places where it's never been before, people start to get very uncomfortable with some of the applications, and rightfully so. I think, you know, look, there was an expectation at one point that you could walk into a store and not have your face tracked everywhere and then have it perhaps married up with, you know, some sort of profile on what you like to buy and how much time you spend in a store and things like that. There are some people who might find that interesting because that might be used to optimize their shopping experience. There are others who would find it downright creepy. And so I think this is where we're at right now in terms of the debate on, you know, just where should boundaries be with face recognition systems and how much control should Americans have or anybody around the world have in terms of the use of these systems. I think the other thing that is coming up right now is that while the technology's gotten better, it's still far from flawless. You know, I talked about back in 2001, it was an interesting idea and the technology was completely unreliable. In 2019, it's improved a lot. It works a lot better. But, you know, there's been a number of stories that have shown up in the last year still about mistakes that the technology makes, you know, that it still will, you know, have error rates and that can mistake, you know, one person for another. There are, you know, some algorithms that have been shown to have some bias in terms of how well do they identify one ethnicity versus another. And so there's, I think, a bunch of issues that are still there. You know, on the algorithms issues and the bias, my take's been it's a really important issue to surface right now. I also assume the technology is going to continue to get better and better. And, you know, we'll come to a point where it really is able to fully automate a lot more identification and decision making. So it's great that things don't have bias. However, if the stuff is getting so powerful that is somehow putting people in less control of their lives, creating privacy and security concerns, you know, essentially disenfranchising people in some cases, that's, I think, where, you know, society, you know, right now is struggling with where should the boundaries be on the applications of this technology.
As far as the federal government's interest in the technology, obviously law enforcement, obviously Homeland Security Department is probably taking the lead on this, and security on their actual sites, federal buildings and whatnot, are of high interest. Are there any other agencies that are looking at it for maybe an idea that isn't out in the news as often or not in CSI, I guess would be the question.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting a lot of applications at border security where, you know, certainly if you talk to the folks at Customs and Border Protection, they see faces supplanting fingerprint, you know, over the next few years as the primary biometric they use because they think it's become reliable enough. But again, that's when I'm in front of a border agent looking straight onto the camera and, you know, or and they're able to compare that to a picture from, say, a visa or passport database. In fact, you're starting to see some biometric-enabled boarding at airports right now where you just look into the camera and they identify you. And they're basically leveraging the fact that when you got a passport, they already had your face. And so they've actually done a pretty savvy way, from my perspective, of mitigating a lot of the privacy concerns around reuse of that while still enabling the functionality. And, you know, the functionality they've been trying to sort out is building something Congress has been asking for over 20 years, which is a biometric-enabled exit system, so you know who's actually leaving the country at any given time. You know, beyond that, I'm sure there's a lot of folks. You know, look, certainly, if you get into the defense community or the crime-fighting community, who can envision a lot of other applications for the technology. I think the question is, where do we start to put boundaries around the applications of it? And I think that's where there's issues. There's another issue I think that you know people are uncomfortable with, and rightfully so, which is that when you come to biometrics, there's an application of the technology. There's a big difference between biometrics that are only stored on your device and used just to unlock that device, and biometrics that are stored in the central database. One of the concerns that I and a lot of other security experts have is that we don't actually know how to protect information that we store in a central database that's valuable, including biometric information. And, you know, exhibit A there is the fact that I and several other million of my colleagues who have spent time in the government community, many of whom are probably listeners to this broadcast, have all of our fingerprints sitting in China right now thanks to the 2015 OPM breach. So, you know, the background on that was, as part of applying for our clearances to work in government, we had to submit all 10 fingerprints. The images were stored, not particularly well protected. And one of the things that China was able to exfiltrate during the OPM breach were all 10 of our fingerprints, which should, you know, be pretty unsettling to people, that even if the government, the U.S. government, can't protect a database of arguably the biometrics of the people who are have the greatest security value to the government, how much is private industry going to be able to do this? How much are other governments around the world? You know, we see across the globe, as people are focusing on building digital identity systems in the third world, we'll do a central biometric database in the third world. And my take is, any central database of information that's valuable, somebody's going to try to figure out a way to get it. So I always point out I'm very comfortable using fingerprints on my smartphone and my laptop to log in, because that's, even though my fingerprints have been compromised and are sitting in another country that might have adversarial interests in terms of how to use them, in order to log into my device, the first thing you have to do is steal my device from me.
Yeah, that's why I was, you know, what is the danger of having your your fingerprints or, you know, your face stolen if you're not physically there? How can they actually use it?
So the short answer is, it's not too hard to come up with a spoof these days. Okay. So, you know, what you see in Mission Impossible isn't so impossible. So there's been scientists for years have been basically, if I can get a picture of your fingerprint, I can come up with a gummy fingerprint or a plastic fingerprint that I can put on most fingerprint sensors and impersonate you.
So it really is, you know, you could make a mask. I mean, in the future,
you could make a mask. You could, look, Hollywood's able to do it. And so can folks who are trying to get at your stuff. And the point I was saying is, even though my fingerprints are sitting in China, I'm perfectly comfortable using local match fingerprint to protect my information. However, the rest of my life, I would never be comfortable if a company wanted to have a central match system of my fingerprint where they were going to somehow keep an image or a template of it in their system to protect it. There's absolutely no way I would ever sign up for that system, because the reality is the Chinese, if they wanted to leverage the images of my fingerprint to get into that system, could do so with relatively little effort. I tend not to trust central match systems to protect anything that I care about.
That's Jeremy Grant, Managing Director for Technology Business Strategy at Venable LLP. Coming up after the break, how does the U.S. keep up with other countries who may not be regulating the biometrics industry as heavily? I'm Eric White.
NEC is the world leader in advanced recognition and artificial intelligence technologies that address today's national defense and homeland security challenges. Their solutions include facial recognition, video surveillance, analytics, intrusion detection, and other biometric security applications, delivering scalable end-to-end technology that enables the safety, security, and economic interests of the United States. Large federal agencies, including DHS, rely on NEC's technology on a daily basis. Learn more at necam.com/ARS.
As other countries take an interest in biometrics and facial recognition technology, how does the U.S. keep up with those countries where privacy and ethical standards are not applied as heavily? I recently spoke with former NIST executive Jeremy Grant about this very topic.
China has been a really interesting case study the last couple of years, in part because, you're right, they do have very different policies and standards and expectations in place in terms of privacy, and they have essentially been rolling out a ton of face recognition across the country with some very sophisticated algorithms. And then they're linking it into what they call a social credit system, where essentially your behavior as you go different places is tracked and scored. And if you are engaging in things that are viewed as somehow uncouth or detrimental to the interests of the country or the party, you might find suddenly that you can't ride a train, you can't go to university. There's a whole bunch of other, you know, consequences that can emerge from the way that you're essentially scored as participating in the surveillance state.
Literally, every American citizen's worst nightmare.
When I look at this, the main thing I have come to the conclusion is, you know, some of the sci-fi writers weren't thinking deeply enough in terms of where this was going when you look at the books we often reference. So, look, it's fascinating to watch and terrifying to watch, and I think everybody agrees we don't want that here. To your question of, does that put the U.S. somehow at a competitive disadvantage because we're not using the technology that way? I don't think so. We're still using biometric technology, including face technology, for a variety of applications. just because we're not applying it poorly in a way that, you know, would blatantly violate the rights of Americans doesn't in and of itself mean that we're going to somehow be at a disadvantage. On the other hand, if we were to make a decision across the board to just not use this technology at all for any purpose, and all of the developers of the tech would flee to other countries, then yes, over time we'd find ourselves at a disadvantage. But I don't see that happening here.
As far as the standards that have been put in place, what has the government said, if anything, about what, you know, this technology can be used for? And has any industry, you know, major industry players come out with, you know, saying, hey, okay, we have this technology, this is what we're going to use it for, don't worry. Yeah, everything's
So the government's been largely silent here, other than I'll say where they have implemented it, they have put privacy policies in place. So there are policies that govern how the FBI's fingerprint information and biometric information can or can't be used. The example I was given before where Customs and Border Protection is leveraging biometrics for automated boarding that ties into a biometric-enabled exit system to their systems has gone through a ton of privacy and security reviews, and there are policies in place that specify exactly, you know, how the information, you know, is collected, how long it's retained, and what application it's applied, and how it should and shouldn't be used. But at a national level, we don't have any legislation that specifically addresses biometrics. At the state level, Illinois has had a biometric privacy law in place for some time. In Europe, you've seen the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, specifically call out biometrics as an area that's considered particularly sensitive and so is worthy of getting additional protections in place. But, you know, we don't have a national privacy law in this country, and we certainly don't have one that ties to biometrics. Although you are seeing in the states more and more legislation pop up, both on the general privacy topic as well as in some cases specifically addressing biometrics because of some of the concerns that we're talking about. On the industry side, I think, while not universally, you know, there have been a number of players in the industry who've long been aware of essentially the issues that are out there with biometrics, particularly the use of face recognition. And so they have been, you know, working on things like voluntary codes of conduct and, you know, trying to get in front of this debate. So you've seen a couple of different biometric trade organizations, you know, have come up with codes of conduct, you know, and policies that, you know, are voluntary, but they try to get their members to agree to that sort of outlines, you know, what they think should be, you know, set in terms of rules that govern the use of the technology.
With no federal action being taken, are there any members on the Hill that have, you know, taken this idea up? Whether I know that your senator is no longer your former boss is no longer on the Hill, but are there any ones that have sort of raised a red flag about this or taken an interest in it?
I think there are members who have taken an interest, although I don't know that I've actually seen any what I would call comprehensive legislation that's actually emerged that would address all of this. So I think there's, although, you know, given the thousands of bills introduced each year, there might be something that I haven't picked up.
I cover them and I haven't seen one.
Yeah.
So I'll just
I haven't seen much other than, you know, this does come up in discussions, certainly with the Hill, you know, so as I'm talking to Hill staffers these days and they're looking for information. You know, I think one of the questions is, how do you create a regulatory framework that's the right approach and the right size. And
that doesn't hamper the technology like we talked about.
Doesn't hamper the technology and also is properly targeted in that, look, I think one thing you'll find up on the Hill is the technology is moving so fast that for the members and the staff just to try to understand where it's going and how it's used, you know, that alone takes quite a bit of time. And so I've seen, you know, even where there have been concerns, some reluctance to put something out there in that there hasn't really been consensus yet in terms of what would be helpful.
Jeremy Grant is Managing Director for Technology Business Strategy at the law firm Venable, formerly an executive for the National Institute of Standards and Technology. If you missed any of this episode, you can find it on our website. Head to federalnewsnetwork.com and click on Federal Insights. I'm Eric White.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights for May, sponsored by NEC Corporation on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network.